I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Christy Sweet, associate professor and head of the Department of Philosophy at Texas A&M. We're discussing her recent book, Kant on Freedom, Nature, and Judgment, The Territory of the Third Critique, from Cambridge University Press. Sweet's main area of interest is in the philosophy of Immanuel Kant, particularly his practical philosophy and aesthetics. She is the author of Kant on Practical Life from Cambridge University Press and many articles. Okay, well, first of all, Christy Sweet, welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Christy, I love this book. I would say it's my favorite book ever on the third critique, but then I'd get in trouble with my sister-in-law. So say it's one of the two best books on the third critique I've read. Congratulations on the book. Let me start just by asking you, what was the motivation for writing on the third critique and taking up these topics?
Well, first, thanks for the high praise and, you know, for this book to be thought of in the category with Rachel Zuckert's book is quite an achievement from my perspective that, you know, was one of, if not the first book to take on the third critique as a unity. And she did a brilliant job of it. So to be anywhere near that category is high praise from my perspective. So thanks. So when I was a graduate student and I first got into Kant, what drew me in was his philosophy of history. I was really struck, I think, by two aspects of it. One was, you know, just on the kind of proactive side, his account of how progress comes about for human beings. But on the other side, I was really kind of, you know, perplexed and drawn into the idea that we need to think that there is a moral progress to human history. And I think that it has a really existential rub in it, this thesis that he has. I mean, he basically observes that all human beings desire to be efficacious in the world. And, you know, the most basic way to put that is that we all would like our actions in the world to make the world better. But the way that the world appears to us can really throw the possibility of that into doubt. You know, things around us look, you know, hopeless or dark or bleak. We, you know, don't seem sometimes to be able to think that we're making any moral progress. And we come to wonder then if our engagement in activities that we think are helping to make the world better are really futile. And Kant thinks that that observation can be really undermining for us in terms of our own moral motivation. So the question of history has this sort of central existential place in individual moral lives for Kant. And I was really struck by and taken with that.
Yeah, that's good. And I think that's a place to begin because it points to the kind of hopefulness or the central question of hope that you read as kind of the central animating question for the third critique. I mean, famously, Kant has these series of questions, which he says animates or, you know, structures or frames the critical system. The famous questions, what can I know? What should I do? And for what may I hope? And the first two critiques typically are understood to answer the first two questions. So it does seem a sensible approach to think of the third critique answering that third question, for what may I hope? So maybe you could say a little bit just sort of at the outset in general about what you take hope to mean in Kant, and what this question essentially is driving at, and the kind of, you know, unifying role that hope plays in Kant's view.
Yeah, so the question of hope typically is treated under the auspices of Kant's practical philosophy, and that's certainly, you know, how I got into it. But what Kant thinks is, you know, we're, it's that question of progress in history, you know, coupled with the fact that things really don't look great in terms of the prospects for you know, getting us where we think we'd really like to be in terms of making the world a better place. He says, well, we really need to have hope that that's possible, that it's possible that the world really be made into the kind of place that we think it ought to be made into. And so hope plays this really load-bearing and central role in practical life for him. But the way that hope is sustained is not only by certain interpretations of history or what he calls signs in history, like the response to the French Revolution, or for us, it might be like the response to the Arab Spring, right? That's sort of a, you know, a more contemporary analogy with the response to the French Revolution. But he seems to think, or I argue in any case, that he seems to think that we have other kinds of experience that can help us sustain our hope. And those two things are beauty, beautiful things, and really living beings, sort of that there is life, and that it has this characteristic or this character to it that is really ineffable to us, as well as just sort of the thatness of that there is life. I think he thinks that these two things point us in the direction of, you know, the possibility that the world really is the kind of place that is fit for us, that we can make into the kind of place that we think it ought to be.
Right. I sometimes get the impression from, you know, the first critique and elsewhere in Kant, and certainly he says this almost explicitly, that nature, under a certain understanding of it, is really inhospitable to human habitation, really, or to human beings are indifferent to our life or indifferent to human activity and virtue. The comet could come just like destroy us tomorrow, and, you know, nature doesn't care. But yeah, so part of, I mean, I think what's illuminating about your reading of the Third Critique, and this is, I think, what you're driving at here, is the two halves of the Third Critique on the beautiful and Critique of Teleological Judgment, that, you know, it's pointing towards a different conception of nature in which human beings are, or a nature that's more benevolent, is that a way to put it? Or a nature that's more hospitable to human ends?
Yeah, that's right. I think hospitable is the term that I would go with. So I think you're absolutely right. He develops a different sense of nature than he relies on in either the theoretical philosophy of the First Critique or the practical philosophy, you know, in the Second Critique or the Groundwork and elsewhere. In the theoretical and practical philosophy, nature really does appear to us just as this kind of mechanistic, conditioned series of events. And it is at best indifferent to us. On the practical side, when, you know, you look at human history, you might even think that, you know, the way our natural desires lead us to do things like get into wars with each other, kill each other, you know, lead to all this strife and violence, that in fact, nature is really opposed to what is good. But I think in the Third Critique, he does develop a different sense of nature. I call it a kind of cosmic sense of nature. And that the idea is that there is this larger whole to which we belong, as well as the kind of mechanistic nature belongs. And there's this sense that, you know, things like natural beauty, living beings, provide this larger natural context into which both human beings and mechanistic nature fit. So that's the kind of, you know, broader systematic kind of account that I try to give of the Third Critique, and the way that I kind of try to work out how he thinks the different parts of his system might fit together. And that's probably a little bit more of a technical scholarly question than existential one, right? About this question, you know, do we belong in the world? Like, is it hospitable for us? Or are we, you know, in this condition of being really alienated from the world in which we find ourselves? Right? Is it opposed to us, or is it going to yield to our ends?
Right. That's great. I mean, the existential question is really useful, and thinking of it as in part of as sort of a comprehensive unifying effort in Kant's own philosophy to sort of bring together the natural, the view of nature that's really developed kind of in the first critique with the view of freedom is developed in the second critique, to sort of bring together the nature and freedom, as it were, you know, is a really, you know, exciting way of thinking about the third critique. And I think kind of consistent with, you say a little bit about this in the book, maybe you can say a little bit about this now. It's, I mean, it's sort of consistent with some of Kant's early readers, mm-hmm. you know, in the 1790s, yeah. Really take up the third critique and see the third critique as, you know, a kind of, you know, a way forward for German idealism. So maybe you want to say a little bit about kind of the readings of the third critique, maybe both then and now. I mean, there are current readings in the Anglo-American scholarship. Mm-hmm. So maybe you want to say a little bit about the, you know, kind of earlier readings and the newer readings and where your approach is sort of diverges from them.
Yeah. So I actually talk a little bit about this in the book. I, you know, was interested in the reception of Kant scholarship, and, you know, it seemed to be really dominated by questions that, at least at first glance for me, seemed to come from outside the text and be sort of, you know, given by things that were not necessarily, you know, going on in Kant's own system. And so, you know, I kind of spent some time thinking about the reception of the book and of Kant really in the Anglophone world. And, you know, for Kant's immediate heirs in the German tradition, they were very interested in system, but also in the kind of existential aspects of systematicity, right? System is something, you know, for Kant and then for his immediate heirs, that is demanded by reason. It's something that we want, right? I think it's really important to remember that for Kant, reason is the faculty of desire. And one of the things that reason desires, or perhaps the main thing reason desires, is that there be a kind of systematicity and order in all things. So it's not just a kind of, you know, scholarly architectonic interest that he has in system. I think, you know, for him, it's something that we really want and that organizes us in sort of all the different spheres of our lives. So I think Kant's, you know, German heirs in the early idealist and romantic traditions, I mean, not all of them, but, you know, had this interest as well. And for them, the third critique was the place where Kant came closest to putting forward a view of how the system could be brought to a kind of coherence. They mostly didn't think he succeeded at that, but that the seeds of success were in that book. I mean, you know, Hegel, I think it's in Faith and Knowledge, you know, says something like Kant, you know, steps right up to the edge and then, you know, kind of looks over and, you know, walks it back. And Hegel's criticism is that for Kant, that unity that might be given in the third critique, it's merely reflective. And, you know, as we kind of all know, for Hegel, you know, that's ontological, that unity. And so he sort of thinks Kant incorrectly balked at the possibility of real unity. And, you know, that those questions about system and the unity of freedom in nature, with that, maybe how beauty, you know, played a fundamental role in that, was something that the idealists and romantics took really seriously. And then you have the rise of neo-Kantianism kind of post-Hegel as a kind of response or rejection to, you know, these big metaphysical questions, these system questions, and, you know, it became married with a kind of commitment to modern science, and you get the predominance of kind of, you know, epistemological questions in the Anglophone reception of Kant. And you see that not only in the attention that's paid to the first critique, or not even really the whole of the first critique, but, you know, really the first half of the first critique, but also, you know, you could say that a lot of the readings of Kant's practical philosophy and its emphasis on the groundwork and certain readings of the groundwork really have an epistemological lathe to them. So I think you can see it kind of across Kant scholarship, this neo-Kantian and, you know, the neo-Kantian Anglophone reception of Kant. And it seemed to me that this did a real disservice to what Kant himself was doing in the Third Critique. And I thought that was kind of evidenced in the early reception of him as well. These people were all, you know, working on a really kind of similar philosophical project and endeavor.
Yeah, that's great. So let's get into your reading of the Third Critique. I think the place to begin where you do in the first chapter is about something you just mentioned a minute ago about the nature of human reason and reason's interests, which is a kind of unusual way of thinking about reason. You know, typically we think of reason as kind of cold and calculating, and then there are the passions or the emotions on the other hand, and that's kind of the way that we tend to think about the human faculties. But Kant didn't think about reason in that way, that reason was had certain kinds of interests, as you say, it's sort of central to the faculty of desire. Thinking about reason and how reason has certain kinds of interests sort of helps frame his critical project as a whole. And then we can think about the place of the Third Critique within it. So maybe you could say maybe a little bit more than you did a minute ago about the sort of reason's interests and how the Third Critique sort of aims to satisfy reason in that way.
Yeah, so that's a really great question. So First, I'll talk a little bit about, Kant names reason as the faculty of desire. That's how he identifies it. And, it's there in the First Critique, but it's really expressed elsewhere that this is what reason is. Reason is the faculty of desire. And what you see in the First Critique, and even in the Second Critique or the Practical Philosophy more broadly, is how desire, our rational desire, that is what we want, outstrips the way that the world is given to us, the way that it appears under the auspices of the understanding in the First Critique, or the way that it currently is in the Practical Philosophy, right? We want it to be another way. We want it to be better than it is. So reason is that thing that draws us beyond our experience of the way the world is, either theoretically or practically. And I mean, it takes us beyond. So reason is the faculty of desire that really outstrips the way that the world is given to us. And that means we are fundamentally dissatisfied, right? Our desire is more and goes beyond the way that things actually are. And so then we have this question, like, are we ever going to satisfy our desire? And, basically in the Theoretical Philosophy and the Practical Philosophy, what Kant is doing is articulating what those interests are that reason has. That is, what is it that we want? What is it that we desire? And on the theoretical side, what we desire is to know everything. We desire to know, is there a beginning of the, cosmos and space and time? Is there a God? Is our soul immortal, right? We are drawn to those things that are unconditioned that would give us knowledge of everything that is in its totality, or what Kant calls an unconditioned whole. That's what we really desire to know, right? And that's the theoretical interest that reason has. You see it in science, in our pursuit of science, our speculation about these questions. And then on the practical side, reason's interest is that the world be fit for us insofar as we are rational beings. So this takes shape in our interest in not only being good individually, that is having a good will, but that certain ends that we have be met, that we belong to a certain kind of democratic republic with laws that are universal, that there's a cosmopolitan world order where peace is secured, right? So these are the things that reason is interested in on the practical side. And that's just to say, that's what we really want. We want the world to be a certain way. We want it to be good. We want it to be better than it is and to, be organized rationally. So that's really what reason wants. That's what its interests are. And that's what it means to say that reason is desire. It's the thing that goes beyond how things appear to or present to us theoretically or practically, and, you know, seeks then to transform the world to be in accord with the way that we think it ought to be.
Is it fair to just summarize it as reason wants to find itself in the world?
I think that's right. I mean, that's I think that's most evident, you know, in the second part of the first critique. That's what reason seeks when it is theorizing or speculating about the way the world is beyond what is given to us in experience. It, you know, posits things. It posits a rational order to nature. And, you know, on the practical side, what reason is really interested in doing is transforming the world so that it is in accord with the structures of reason, and that reason sort of, you know, sees itself everywhere in the world. Yeah. So that is very much what reason wants. And I think, you know, not to be too technical about it, but, you know, reason for Kant is unconditioned. And what reason seeks in its desiring character is the unconditioned and to be the unconditioned. And so, you know, it is grounding in being the unconditioned, but it is fundamentally in relation to nature or the world. And in that relation, what it seeks is to bring all of those aspects, all of those things that constitute nature and the world, under its own purview and make them part of itself as an unconditioned totality. That's kind of a technical way of talking about, you know, what it is that reason wants.
No, that's useful. I mean, and just to add in, I think the, you know, another sort of framing image that you use, which is this idea of the territory, which is in the subtitle of your book. Kant uses this term several times in the third critique, which I hadn't noticed until I read your book, which is really useful. That there's something about reason's judgments here in the third critique that occurs, as it were, out in the territory. So it's there's a kind of what provisionality to the reflection. Maybe instead of me trying to try to summarize this, maybe you could say a little bit about why this use of the territory as an image or metaphor, and what do you take it to mean?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So, Kant thinks, well, there are spheres of human life that are determinate, right? Where there is kind of a way that things actually are, and we can know that and or do that. And so he's like, yeah, there are things that we can know, and we know that we know them. And, you know, we've got a kind of security in that. And then, you know, on the practical side, he thinks, you know, what we should do is really clear, right? Reason is not ambiguous in how it tells us to act or what to pursue. But there's this gap between what it is that we want, right? Between what we desire and how things actually are. And in that gap, things really aren't determinate, right? We want to know, can we, you know, close that gap? Or as he says, can we bridge that incalculable gulf between those to, you know, things that we want and, you know, how we think things ought to be and how they are. Can we traverse that, that distance? And, you know, between those two things, he thinks there's this whole sphere of human life that, is constituted by a kind of indeterminacy. Now, for all that indeterminacy, it's not, you know, kind of an open field of play. So this is what he calls the territory of reflection. So he thinks there's this whole sphere of our experience. Well, it doesn't quite belong to knowledge, but it also doesn't belong to the sphere of action. Like, there's this whole realm of experience that we have to use our good judgment about. One name for that might be interpretation. But that interpretation, he thinks, is key to still the way that things appear. So it's not like fantasy or pure imagination. It is tied to the way things are. And he thinks that it's there in that indeterminate sphere of human experience that we find, kind of provisionality, or we find suggestions that what it is that we want can be met, can actually be achieved. So on the practical side, Kant writes, this, he entertains the question, is the human race constantly progressing? And he says, well, can't really determine that. But we have this sort of funny experience, right? We all saw after the French Revolution or during the French Revolution, everyone else was really enthusiastic about it. And he says, well, that kind of gives us a sign that there is this moral trajectory, this sort of moral nugget at the heart of human beings, right? We really want our freedom. So, how do you interpret the enthusiasm surrounding the French Revolution and the rest of Europe? I mean, there are probably lots of ways to do that, but Kant says, here's a way to interpret that, meets reason's interests. Okay, but then in the third critique, he says, we really have these experiences that on their own suggest to us that reason's interests can be met. What I was interested in talking about the territory was that there was a sphere of experience that was not governed by reason's interest, but nevertheless spoke to them. So we have this experience of beautiful things, and that stands outside of knowledge or of our moral interests, but the kind of experience that it is and the thing that it appears to us as nevertheless can indicate to us that there is this deeper unity between human freedom or I hesitate to use the word because I don't really want to be misinterpreted, but a kind of spiritualized order and the natural order. I kind of talk about that a little bit in the book in the section on genius and aesthetic ideas. And I hesitate to use the word spiritualized, but Kant talks about spirit and the spiritedness of beautiful artworks. And it's in that we see, aha, things really might not be so bad. There might be this larger thing to which we belong. And we have these experiences, as I put it in the book, out in the territory that can suggest this to us.
Yeah. So if I have the metaphor right, is the idea that we live in some sense in a, metaphorically in a under the rule of law or something, right? Mm-hmm. Under the rule of the law of the understanding and of practical reason and so forth, and these give us sort of determinative guidance. But then when we like leave the city walls, as it were, and go out into the territory, right, the sort of state of nature image, the sort of the territory, and when we don't have lawful structure that's given, reason has to be more suggestive and interpretive in its efforts. And again, as you say, it's not like we make stuff up when we go out into the state of nature or in the territory. I mean, nature gives us some kind of guidance, but it's still pretty indeterminate because there are lots of ways. I mean, I guess to use another metaphor, I don't know if this is helpful, but things like creating a map or, being a cartographer, right? You can sort of map terrains based on kind of a wide number of different approaches to it. Many of them are going to be sort of accurate in some ways, but they pick up on different things. I don't know if that's useful, but I mean, does that kind of hit on the metaphor that he's trying to develop here?
Yeah, I think that's really well said. I really like this idea of cartography, actually. That's really nice. And that image of the city walls, I think that's right. Like the understanding has determinate laws that determine what our experience is. Reason gives us the laws for good behavior, basically, right, that govern the will. And then and those are what he calls domains. And, I think you can think of that as being inside the city walls, right? It's really determinate, it's circumscribed, what objects, show up to us what way. But then when you leave the city walls, it's not a free-for-all, And we have what he calls reflection, which is a capacity that is that employs the principle of purposiveness. So when we interpret things, we're still guided by questions of like, well, what is the purpose of this thing being the way that it is? And we will then seek to interpret whatever it is that shows up to us out in the territory in a way that answers that question. And we still have available to us, you know, the concepts of the understanding, even though they're not going to be organized and determined in the way that they might be in the context of knowledge.
Right. So you, in the next several chapters, I mean, just sort of apply this approach to, you know, kind of what you discuss several topics in the first part of the third critique on the beautiful. I mean, maybe you could just start just by orienting us about reflective judgments about beauty. What is it that these judgments are doing for Kant? I mean, presumably they're sort of suggestive or evocative of something in nature, that nature sort of reflects something about it. Is it that nature reflects something about us, or there's something beyond us that that sort of exceeds our capacities? What is it that the judgments of the beautiful are doing, you know, on Kant's view?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a really big question. So I'll start with my discussion of the ideal of beauty, which I think is, you know, kind of runs against the grain of a lot of interpretation of that section of the book. People have been pretty dismissive of it. They think it doesn't really fit, or it's a throwback. But I thought, you know, Kant says in this section that this forms the kind of pattern for all of our judgments of taste. And, you know, I think in general, I try to figure out, well, why does he think he thinks that? what's really going on? How can we make sense of this? And I think ultimately what he comes to there is that the highest instance of beauty is, I mean, he says it's going to be a morally good human being, but not only someone who follows the moral law, but whose moral goodness imbues their physicality in this thoroughgoing way. I mean, it might be, you know, you might think of it along the lines of what Schiller calls grace, but it's not just that someone does their duty, but that the principle of freedom in them is so determined that the way that they move, the way that they speak, embodies our free being. And he thinks that's going to be the thing that forms an ideal for us, that presents an ideal. And what that is, in the book, I suggest that the way to understand that is of a thoroughly spiritualized matter. So, you know, I kind of refer back to Kant's early writings on life and kind of draw out, you know, the idea of life or living forces as, or life as life force that animates matter. And, you know, how to think about that's really difficult, but I do think that's ultimately the thing that Kant has in mind as the measure of what makes something beautiful. That there's a kind of spiritualization to matter, but that's excessive. So I think the thing that you picked up on, you know, and, you know, wondering, well, you know, is there something that exceeds us? We don't necessarily see ourselves reflected, right? In our experience of the beautiful, what is presented to us exceeds what we can grasp through the concepts of our understanding, right? There's more given to us than we can simply comprehend, which is why what we get is an interpretation of it, and a kind of indeterminate and, you know, perhaps even ongoing interpretation. So you can probably tell already that I kind of reject the formalist interpretation of Kant's theory of beauty. Not that that's not there, but I think that's pretty minimal with respect to the whole of the text. So I think that's like, that's how the beautiful thing shows up to us. And I think what that means for Kant or what Kant thinks that means for us is that there's this much deeper thing going on in nature, in the human world, than simply what appears to us according to the concepts of the understanding as a mechanistic nature. And that's something that exceeds us and to which we belong.
Yeah, that's great. I think, let me just throw this as an example back at you. Maybe if this is sort of meshes with your reading, I'm reminded of the Schiller has these letters to Kerner. I think one of his friends, Kerner, and he is, I think, develops a quasi, you know, a reading of the beautiful along these lines. And basically he thinks of the beautiful as something that sort of is self-determining or exhibits a kind of freedom in the form of being self-determining. And so he uses this example of a horse, one horse that's beautiful because its body is just, you know, is a form of perfect movement that every sort of part is interdependent and meshes with itself. Whereas then he thinks of the example of a lame horse, and a lame horse is ugly to our eyes because it's not self-determining. There's something external to it, like some natural force that's inhibiting its movement. And we see that inhibition and it offends our eyes. And so this idea, the ideal of the beautiful, which sort of picks up on, it seems to me, something about our sort of moral self-determination as a kind of index or standard of beauty. I wonder if that's, is that, you know, is it the Schiller sort of interpretation, sort of picking up on what you're after here, or is that maybe is distinct from what you're saying?
Yeah, that's, well, I think I'm gonna have to think more about that. I think there are a lot of different ways to have a Kantian approach to that Schiller example. The idea that beauty is self-determining, though, I think is something that's in Kant. I mean, the entire, or one of the things that Kant really gives to us is this idea that truth, beauty, and goodness are not identical, right? In the classical tradition, those things are interchangeable. And Kant says, no, they're actually really distinct and, you know, separate spheres of human life. They relate to each other in these very interesting, complicated ways, but they cannot be reduced to each other. They don't form a intrinsic or inherent unity, even though he wants to systematize them. But beauty then, has its own, how to put it, being its own sphere, then, you know, is its own thing. And, you know, I think in art, you probably see it even more than in natural beauty. Art objects appear to us as art objects. Like, there is a thing that art is, and it is different from other kinds of things. And it is in that way, self-grounding and self-presenting, whatever else it is, you know, whether or not it's beautiful, even, it is self-grounding and self-presenting as an art object. It's not useful. It's not simply something useful that's well designed, right? It is, you know, to sort of invoke a cliche, arts for art's sake. And we recognize these objects. I mean, what's really interesting is that we recognize art objects as art objects, as having this their own distinct kind of being. And that they're not governed by, anything external to them. And that's a really interesting feature, I think, of art. And I do think, if you take sort of Schiller's account of the example you gave and what it is that makes the horse beautiful in that way, then I think it is really close to Kant. And that's something that he definitely has bequeathed to us, that there is a self-standing character to the beautiful and, you know, especially to art.
Yeah. I wonder if that connects to the discussion of the genius, which I also found, a helpful discussion in thinking about how the genius relates to nature and particularly to spirit. This notion, you've used this notion spirit a couple of times, and this is a notion that appears explicitly in his discussion of genius, that sometimes we think of the genius in Kant as a, you know, kind of like self-creative thing, you know, some sort of, you know, creation ex nihilo. But it's, you know, what I'm reading from your account is it's very helpful in the sense that, you know, the genius points towards actually the way in which nature can impinge on human creative activity, that nature sort of can speak through the genius, and nature, something that exceeds us, like the natural world, actually can touch us, connect us, through this figure of this sort of this creative figure of the genius.
Great. So Kant's discussion of the genius is really wild. The idea that Kant, the sort of Kant we have in our imaginations, would write what he does about the genius is, I mean, it's fantastic. So one of the things I try to do in the book is say, well, what is Kant actually trying to give an account of here? You know, it's hard to understand where that is in the book, or in the third critique rather. But what I try to motivate is that I think he's giving a kind of deduction of art. And the question can be put this way. How is it possible that art exists? That is, how can it be that human beings can create this thing that exceeds our own capacities for understanding and interpreting it? I mean, it's a really interesting way of thinking about the question of art and how it comes into being. And I think that is how we need to understand his account of genius, that is in the context of that question. How is it that human beings, given what they are, can create this thing that ultimately exceeds our own capacities for receiving it? And the account he gives then is of the genius, which he names the favorite of nature. And his description of the genius is of someone who has not chosen to be a genius, but has been selected by nature to be a kind of conduit of, you know, some deeper thing going on in nature. I mean, you know, Kantians are all, I'm sure, very unhappy to hear me talk that way about it. But when he talks about the you know, spirit as a sort of movement of aesthetic ideas, which exceed our capacity for representation, he calls them, you know, pendants and counterparts of the ideas of reason. The idea is that there is something excessive that nature allows the genius access to, and then, you know, allows them to be able to present this to the rest of us through art. So, you know, the genius, I really love this idea. I think Kant would say people really don't choose to be a genius. And in fact, you might not choose to be a genius. it's sort of more than, you know, the rest of us might be able to endure in taking on the sort of, you know, excessiveness of understanding and insight. And he thinks that the genius has been chosen by nature as a kind of vehicle to present those things to the rest of us.
Right. So I wanted to turn to the second half of the third critique, and hence the second half of your book on the critique of teleological judgment. I mean, we could just orient us in the sense of, you know, what is the unifying link, I guess, here between the, you know, on the one hand, this is a classic question about this book on the third critique. On the one hand, you have a book that's about the beautiful. We've been talking about beauty. And then on the other hand, you have a book that's about biological organisms. And isn't that weird? Like, what is it that these things, what is it that unifies these two as a way of transitioning to discussion of the second half?
Yeah, that's really hard. And I worry that I didn't do well enough at it in my book. So, you know, in the first half of the book, I think Kant presents what I'm calling this cosmic sense of nature, this idea that we belong to this larger system. So, you know, in his theoretical philosophy, you know, we get to know things, Right. We know things, and then we have this desire to know things that we simply, you know, speculate about, although he wants to curb that. On the practical side, in practical philosophy, we have the use of freedom. But then there's this territory where that he thinks mediates between, you know, freedom and nature. And, you know, what I try to do is say, well, our experience in that territory is of this broader connectivity or kind of system to which all three spheres belong in some way. So in that way, freedom and nature are recast as two parts of a larger whole. You know, I think that if, you know, you just read the theoretical philosophy, you just read the practical philosophy, you get a very reductive kind of bad modern account of the human being, right? Where, you know, we've got this first person perspective and we are simply, you know, prosecuting that in the world in these various ways, right? Either scientifically or in terms of transforming the world. But I think what the territory does, what our experience is both of beauty, what our experience of beauty does is it recasts that first person perspective in a broader context. And so we come to take ourselves, I think, in this larger cosmic sense of nature to be part of something larger than ourselves. So that first person perspective that you can get out of the theoretical philosophy or, you know, come away with in the second critique or the practical philosophy gets displaced. So I think that's what happens in the account of beauty in the first part of the book. And then I actually think the second part of the book kind of fits within that larger sense of nature. And I think what the critique of teleological judgment is trying to do is within that larger cosmic whole, right, where you've got the three parts of the system that relate in this sort of interesting way, you could take the critique of teleological judgment and the account of living beings and the order of nature that Kant gives there and drop that into the theoretical sphere that is also within the larger whole. Okay, so that probably wasn't as clear as it needed to be. The interesting thing about Kant's account of living beings is that that's sort of a catalytic moment in his argument. What he's interested in there is a kind of larger or a broader order to nature that is teleological, that is where discrete things within nature relate to each other in some kind of ordered, systematic, and then it turns out teleological way. So he's asking the question there, well, are we legitimate in using the principle of teleology to organize the whole of nature? And he means nature, like mechanistic nature, right? Can, you know, mechanistic nature be thought of as part of this sort of larger teleological whole? And living beings show up in the context of that question. And he says, well, that there are living beings, that there are organisms that we really can't account for any other way than organically and teleologically legitimates the use of this teleological principle in understanding and organizing the whole of nature. So what he wants to do in the critique of teleological judgment, at least in the first part of living beings, is legitimate understanding the whole of the natural order, you know, as a systematic whole. He wants to legitimate us thinking of it that way. So I actually think what he's doing there is like the domain of nature that he talks about in the beginning, right, which is organized by these mechanistic laws. What he's doing is he says, well, look, we can understand that in this broader context as well. And then in the second part of the critique of teleological judgment, where he's talking about God, what he's really doing is saying, well, look, that systematic account that we've just legitimated, of nature as a whole, that it is teleologically oriented, forms, the telos of that can really only be human beings. That's the only thing that can serve as this proper end of a teleological nature. I mean, when you work out the argument, it's actually really spectacular, I think. And so he thinks that that end, the only thing that can serve as a proper end of nature so that it can be organized teleologically and thus systematically is the human being, right? That's the only thing it can be. And so it forms this sort of node or linchpin that then links the theoretical and practical philosophies together in this new and interesting way. I'm sorry, that I realized that was a lot.
No, it's great. I was wondering maybe if I try to simplify it massively and you tell me where this distorts your... It strikes me that, you know, I mean, one of the kind of unifying links here is this notion of life, right? You develop how life is sort of central to thinking about the ideal of beauty. And then life, of course, is a sort of, you know, underlies the kind of organic character. And life, you know, biology is a difficult concept for the sort of, you know, mechanistic view that Kant develops in the first critique to get grasp on. And so I guess one way to think about the third critique is kind of two different perspectives on life. That is, life as a sort of phenomenon in which we can find ourselves sort of exceeded by nature, right? And an experience of the beautiful is one where nature sort of exceeds our powers, or an approach to life in which we can find our actual distinctive vocation and place within it. That is, at this sort of the pinnacle of nature. You know, when Kant talks in the appendix, the Critique of Teleological Judgment, and there's this view of the philosophy of history that we kind of started with, and human beings end up being the sort of ultimate end of nature. It's sort of amazing moment, as you're saying. So nature kind of exceeds us in the first half, but that then we sort of recapture the pinnacle of nature in the second half. How's that? Yeah.
That is such a great point. I know that you're really interested in this question of the meaning of life in Kant. And so, what I hear you asking is, well, look, is the meaning of life, given by this larger, what I call a cosmic sense of nature to which we belong, or is it that nature is ultimately for us, right, as it is in the teleology? And I actually think that the teleology can be, and I think Kant thinks of it this way too, actually, can be brought under the auspices of the cosmic sense of nature. So I think in the end, we find ourselves as part of this larger cosmic order, or this larger system, this thing that exceeds us. But that excessiveness is what buttresses or supports our moral vocation. So there's an interesting relation. It's not really dialectical. I don't think they can be reduced to each other. I'd have to think more ultimately about how I would want to characterize that relation. But I do think that excessiveness supports us, right? That's what suggests to us that it's possible that our vocation can be met. And there's always this weird thing in Kant. I mean, you know, his immediate heirs are really critical of him for this, right? So even though I talked about how earlier reason is unconditioned for Kant, people like Fichte and Hegel, especially, going to criticize Kant's notion of reason for not really being unconditioned or unconditioned enough. They say, no, Kant, actually, the way that you talk about reason and the way it's related to nature is that it is conditioned by these things outside of it to achieve its own ends. And, I find this one of the most interesting tensions in Kant's work. And I think this does come up again in this thing you're pointing to, where on the one hand, we belong to this larger, you know, order, there is this excessiveness, but then, you know, are we maybe just returned to this sort of what we might call a bad modern perspective, right? The thing that everyone's critical of, where the human being is the ultimate, you know, end of nature, and so on. Or, you know, how can we be generous and think those two things together? And I think he does want to hold those two things together, where that excessiveness is both a context for us, but also the thing that buttresses you know, the particular kind of moral vocation that we have. So it's a really interesting kind of, you know, sense of being part of something larger than yourself.
Right. It's helpful. I mean, it can't be that Kant is just returning to the like great chain of being kind of view, where you find your vocation vis-a-vis some kind of ordered metaphysical structure, because he's the great crusher of metaphysics. So he's not going to subscribe to that view. But I think what you're helpfully pointing to is that, you know, he's also not a straight up Baconian in the way that might be suggested. You know, the first critique there, the epigraph, is to Bacon's, what is it, the great instauration, right? And it's sort of, but you know, so Kant can't be a Baconian either, where it's just sort of the great domination of nature by reason, but some sort of, I mean, this is the power of the third critique, that it's able to be suggestive, that you know, reason points towards some sort of mysterious natural order that's beyond us, and necessarily beyond us, but yet that we also have this sort of vocation or role to play within it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes complete sense, and it really is just a fascinating move. You know, and I find it, Kant's, you know, of course, can be a lot richer than the, you know, stereotypes, but also I think this is, people probably don't give him enough credit for, it's really complicated thing about reason, right? Where, you know, reason really does want itself and want what it wants. But the way that it looks like it can get that is only in virtue of belonging to something that exceeds it. And somehow that's not really contradictory. You know, I think you'd probably have to do a lot of work to work that out. But I think that is kind of how, in the end, his system ends up, you know, holding together. And, you know, we remain, you know, human beings who have a moral vocation that's given by a reason itself, but that we do also belong to this larger thing. And like you said, it's not a return to this ancient cosmology, you know, great chain of being kind of thing. But those things that exceed us are still really integral to and crucial to our success as rational beings.
Can I ask you to conclude with thinking about the last chapter, where you take up Kant's philosophy of religion, so theological views? Because I learned something here, because I always thought of, you know, Kant's discussion here as, you know, similar to what he developed earlier in terms of a sort of practical argument for the existence of God. But you point out important ways in which, you know, sort of Kant's building on and changing his views about the sort of his theological views. So, you know, how does Kant change here in the third critique, and how does that sort of fit within the broader concerns you've been discussing here?
Yeah. So I think that's a really central question to what motivated me. And I think what motivated me, you know, my interest in Kant on this question, but also I think you can see a kind of evolution in Kant's own thinking. So you mentioned the postulates of practical reason in the second critique. And there's a postulate of God, where Kant basically says, you know, in order for us to think that the ends that reason prescribes to us are possible, we need to postulate that there's a God who is the moral author of nature. And what God gets us in that section is really, I think, the idea that nature is already organized teleologically and is amenable to moral ends. But what's most interesting about Kant's evolution, I think, is that in that section of the second critique, you know, the postulates are generated by reason for a reason. They really don't touch down anywhere. And I think Kant becomes very dissatisfied with that. I think he thinks we need something more to sustain the hope we have that the ends reason gives to us are realizable. That, you know, hope, I think, for him, needs to be sustained by, I mean, I don't want to say evidence, because that's entirely too strong, but we need to have, you know, something that actually gives us hope. It can't just be generated by reason for reason. I mean, that's not really gonna do it for us. So, you know, what shows up in the sign in history, and then ultimately in the third critique for him, I think, is that something actually appears to us this way. Namely, nature appears to us as having a structure that is not simply mechanistic. So we don't just need to postulate God. We actually have something like an experience of nature, both in natural beauty, but also in living beings, that nature is other than it appears to us under the auspices of the understanding. And so you get a kind of empirical representation that we legitimately judge to be purposive. So, that gets us a good way, or, it helps mediate the problem that, nature appears to us as mechanistic and against our rational ends. And so, in that mediating role, it can really sustain our hope. So I think there then, the question of God as it's posed in the second critique really falls away. I think Kant's dissatisfied with that in terms of what can sustain our hope as moral beings. And then, in the second half of the book, in the teleology, God kind of comes back as the moral author, but in a way where it's God's not postulated, but we can have conviction. And conviction is such an interesting idea in Kant. It's not, again, it's not faith. It's not something reason has just posited, or is illusory about, but things, appear to us in a way where it's legitimate to have a judgment that God exists, to be convicted by that. Where like you could actually point to things and to way things are, in a public way, right? He talks about like, it's got to be shareable. You got to be able to talk to other people about this, right? Can't just be something you feel in your heart or have come up with on your own, right? There's got to be this way that things are, at least appear in some way, that warrants that conviction. And I think he thinks that the teleological ordering of nature, with its being indexed to the moral vocation of human beings, gives us that.
Yeah, there's a trace of the supersensible in the sensible, right? I mean, there's the bumper sticker for you, the critique, right? There's
That's
a trace.
Right.
Yeah,
you could have blurbed the book. You just summarized it.
There you go. For the beautiful and for teleological, that there's some trace always there for us to grasp.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And Kant's clear about that in the introduction to the text.
Great. Well, Christy, this has been a lot of fun. I always love talking about Kant, of course. So it's great to have someone who wrote a great book on it to help guide me through this. So thanks again for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Well, you're really kind. You're really kind to have me. And this has been great fun. So thanks.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.